Blog Talk Radio. Hello, and welcome to Awakenings. Welcome everyone in the chat room and those that are tuning in via cosmicdimensions.com. And that's cosmicdimensions.biz for those of you that want to tune in to later segments. And welcome to those that are listening to the archives later on. We appreciate you. We appreciate all of you listener participants. I'm your host, co-pilot, Michelle Mache, walking these steps of the journey with you, flowing and floating through the twists and changes and sometimes stumbling, but getting up, dusting off, and moving forward. I hope everyone is having a wonderful Wednesday, wherever you are, and that you're present to this moment that is reflecting something so important, your life. It's reflecting your life. That is something really important. I think more people are waking up and realizing this. Awakenings Radio highlights conscious living for conscious lives. Here at Awakenings, we consider this a place for awakening conversations with artists, musicians, metaphysicians, spiritually minded people, and progressive thinkers in their own fields that are waking up, are awake, and awakening more and revealing and reflecting their awakening through various means, whether politically, spiritually, through their art, music, or simply by their way of being in the world, all have one common thread of an awakening and being inspired to do something with this new level of being. Awakenings hosts dialogues and interviews with spiritual teachers, healers, conscious experts. All are in the awakened state. This is a place for bridging science and spirituality. And Awakenings is a timely relaying of essential information, insights, inspiration, and tools for transformation and spiritual unfoldment. And Awakenings, most importantly, is interactive and live. It's about grounding the spiritual process of awakening. But what makes it wonderful is that it is a live program with interaction, which I love, meaning that it is really about the listener participants. It's about you in the sacred space of empowerment, also known as the chat room. It's about those that are calling in, those that are texting or tweeting me on Twitter, your emails. It is about all of you with your thoughts, your suggestions, your feedback. It's about also, in the sacred space of empowerment room, those that are shining their light, sharing their insight to the people that are in the chat room as well, that are basically stepping up into their life. So it's all about all of us and in the converging flow. This is, many of you have heard me speak of this before, the harmonic convergence of the late 80s, where we had this harmonizing, which I believe we just had the anniversary of the harmonic convergence, I believe was August 16th or 17th. And it's a reminder that we are harmonizing, that there is this harmonization overall, even though there looks like there's chaos and conflict on the outside. And in many sectors of our world, there are. There is some chaos. There's some disharmony. But out of that disharmony comes harmony. And sometimes out of conflict, we move into the space of harmony, of better understanding. In the Native American traditions, understanding means to stand under. You know, so the only way I can really know someone is if I'm in their life, if I'm standing under them, looking through them at their life. And so we are in this amazing flow right now, challenging at times, but that we're being called to understand ourselves better and understand each other better. And out of that harmonizing has and continues we continue to move into the convergence. And this convergence, look up the word, it's an amazing, the converging flow to me is very exciting because it's the recognition that your spirituality, your spiritual awareness is not predicated or dictated by what you know, how you look, what classes you took, if you were white, if you're vegan or, you know, vegetarian or meat eater, non-meat eater, hunter, non-hunter. It is people waking up. You know, if we look at it metaphysically, the DNA encoding is being decoded. There's a waking up. Kind of like how, you know, when we're growing up, we all develop at a little bit different time. Some people read a little sooner. Some people walk a little sooner. Some people, you know, read earlier. Some people are more into, you know, things with manual dexterity, working with their hands. Some people do that better. And then later on, maybe they move into the verbal skills. So we all kind of have our own evolvement a little bit differently. It's not all exactly at the same time in the same way. And so in this converging flow, there is this convergence or confluence, and confluence also, you know, integrating influence, where people all over the world, in all fields, all walks of life, all areas, have the similar understanding or awakening to consciousness and are stepping forward in their lives and living this or manifesting this or demonstrating this. And when I think of this, I almost think of, you know, people coming to a center point from all over the world, you know, somebody, a guy with a briefcase, a woman with a briefcase and heels, you know, a construction worker with a hard hat, a mother with her children, a father with his children, you know, Lance Armstrong on his bicycle, a rock and roller coming with his guitar, you know, writer, a painter, everybody coming with their, you know, their tools of whatever they do in their life, and just coming from the hills, coming from the cities, coming from the mountaintops, coming from the beach, coming from the inner city, a rapper coming through, you know, everybody just coming through and coming in this wonderful center point. Now, perhaps that doesn't happen. I mean, in the harmonic convergence, this is exactly what people did. They held hands and came together, you know, as a human chain across the world. But this way, you know, maybe there will be a converging flow. Maybe somebody, I'll put it out there, maybe somebody will do an event on that. But it's best coming through our consciousness that we're coming into this awareness or a center point in consciousness. And you'll see there's actually a movie that's trying to get funding that's called The Converging Flow, which that really tickled me. And then the other day, actually, a new Twitter friend, company has something about convergence. And they blend video and some other mediums together. And I direct messaged her and said, oh, I love that term. I said, it's so amazing. I said, you're seeing, you know, more of that, because that's what everyone is realizing, that there is this convergence of what technology, spirituality, science, there's a convergence of internet, TV, you know, iPod, iPhone, am I missing anything? You know, computer, you know, there is this video, media, you know, audio, there's this convergence where it all comes together for a wonderful unfoldment, a wonderful new creative expression that has more consciousness, more awareness. And anyway, and the woman that direct messaged me back, she said, yes, you know, I think it was 8 years or 10 years ago when they first came up with that title, you know, for their company, the name of the company, that not a lot of people had heard of it and wondered, what is that? What is that about? And she said, now you're seeing it more and more, that more people are using this term, are recognizing it. And if you're, Anne Blackman is her name, and she said, you're right, reconvergence. When we started our grant in 2004, no one, she put that in caps, knew what we were talking about. Much more fun these days. Yeah, because more people are understanding that we are all part of a convergence. And also what excites me about that is that because we're part of a convergence, we have what I like to call mitigating consciousness. You know, if you watch those lawyer TV shows, those mitigating circumstances. You know, in other words, something that, you know, it can change the outcome of something, you know, either for the, you know, what we want to call good or bad. You know, someone does a crime, but, you know, mitigating circumstances are, you know, something, you know, makes it lesser because, you know, they were upset or whatever the situation is, or they were out of their mind, so, or they're really sorry, or they've made restitution. People kind of forget, especially a lot in this, you know, new age, old age community, very often with light workers, are looking at a lot of what's happening or to be happening in 2012 as it's a done deal. Well, as there's more people converging or in this confluence, there is influence that is taking over. There is an influence, meaning that we are, just even as we speak, as we're all connecting right here, right now, we are mitigating the outcomes that people are feeling are to be very extreme. So our consciousness is extremely, extremely powerful. And it's known in, you know, in esoteric and metaphysical circles that those that are coming with a stronger intention for the greater good outlast those of a lesser intention, or those that are perhaps, I don't want to say negative or positive, but that, let's say, less life-enhancing or less productive. I don't know if any of you have ever seen this, but I have definitely seen this. If one person speaks up, let's say against somebody, and I've seen this when I was, you know, going to school, I was always the one protecting the bullies. protecting those that were getting bullied. A lot of times just one person speaking up or saying, no, let's not do that, you know, shifts the tides. Fiona is saying, me too, Michelle, in the chat. You too? Yeah. I did it with my one brother. If you're ever listening, Steve, because I was very popular. He later was popular, but I don't know. Somehow I got along with everybody. It didn't matter what their clique was, sorority, surfers, the artists, the new agers, the fringy types, it didn't matter. And Michael Emmanuel in the chat's putting bully protection service. I love it. It was amazing just sometimes just to talk down to them or say, no, don't do that, or, you know, or just to come to their aid. It would just shift. And I've not only experienced this, I know other people that have also experienced this as well, where they have relayed stories to me like this, that they just spoke up or they showed disinterest and it just kind of puttered out, died out, you know, the situation didn't escalate. So it's the same thing, you know, Fiona in the chat's putting the world as our clique. That is for sure. Wow. We're a universal clique here. So that's the same thing, as our consciousness is more on connecting, on life enhancement, on self-expression, on creativity, on healing, on, you know, empowerment, encouragement, on awareness. As we're focused more and more on that, it really does get traction. And if you've ever noticed, most people, I mean, I'm even thinking of the worst crimes here, most people really don't want to do that unless they're hopped up into something. You know, it kind of gets rolling. And I'm sure some of you remember when you've even lost your temper, it kind of just escalates, you know, rolls, you know, it rolls. But if there's something that distracts you or something that is no charge, indifferent, that, you know, extreme energy in motion doesn't have anything to gain traction, you know, and that's why, Fiona's saying, isn't the principle resonance? Well, yes, it's altering the resonance in a sense. But this is why also, you know, obviously times to fight, or, you know, if you have to go you know, go in that direction or speak up or you know, you're being attacked or something. Obviously, there's something like that. But for the most part, and this is why to go into neutrality, to even in consciousness, not to fight against or to go against, because if we take a position, we're playing out a 3D drama, an interesting, you know, third and fourth dimensional experience where there's polarity, and the polarities will play out. But if you're neutral, not victim-y, there's a big difference. If you're neutral, if you don't have the charge, then less and less of that can gain traction and play out. And the reason why I'm sharing this is that, you know, in hopes that as people, you know, we have people listening to this all over the world, and then also maybe if those of you that this resonates with you, that you feel this, that you begin to perhaps, if you have this viewpoint as well, to share it with more people, it begins to offstave, to minimize the foreseen extreme situations that people are predicting that we need to go through to have the evolution that we're already, you know, that they think is going to happen, but by the way, everybody, it's already happening. So Michael Emmanuel is saying neutral or objective or both. Well, that's a really good point, Michael. Michael's question in the chat. Well, if I'm neutral, I can see both sides, and I'm not in, I have a preference on the ego level, perhaps, of one, but I'm not engaging. And I guess that's the idea. When we're for something or for against something, we begin to enact the opposite. So we can be objective. We can look at something objectively. Seriously, you're right. When you're neutral, you're in the position of the of both. You're both magnetic and electrical. You're not engaging in the polarity or of one or the other. And this is why you see a lot of bouncing around right now politically. What's going on? You can see it really playing out, even with the quote unquote religious uprising or wars or, you know, disagreements, if you will. A lot of that would just neutralize and transform into another level of awareness, another level of understanding, if there wasn't the fight for who's right and who, and because if someone has to be right, then someone has to be wrong. And that gets that traction going. So as we do less of that and we're focused on our own self-expression, then there is less of that. Now, Fiona's asking in the chat, does there have to be someone who is right? No, both people actually are. I mean, if you get into the expanded consciousness of the all that is, there is only right action. And whether that's doing non-action is still action, right? So we don't know what somebody is going through on a soul level or what's going on. I mean, that's why I really have, for the last few years, moved into the space of using the term if something is life-enhancing, because we all know what that is. But there can be something that's right in one situation and perhaps wrong in another. So Debbie is saying right and wrong are a problem of the ego. Yeah, I mean, we have preferences, but I don't, you know, it's, again, certain things are right in one point and for you and perhaps at another time wrong. And again, that comes back to someone's own wisdom, someone's own inner knowing, someone's own awareness. You know, someone saying, you know, you don't drink orange juice, you know, you're on this special program. And that, so it's not right to drink the orange juice then, but then months later it's, you're off the program and orange juice is fine again, you know. So it's, you know, I know that's a silly example here, but trying to keep it light in essence. But I think that it's when we get locked in, preferences are part of, you know, of the ego personality. We are all individuated aspects of the all that is. We're individuated consciousness. So that means we're unique. We're going to have likes and dislikes and preferences. Michael Emmanuel in the chat is saying preferences, yes, flexible and releasable. Yeah, oh, I love that. Flexible. Ooh, Michael, that's good. You got to tweet that. Flexible and releasable. Yes, that's a preference. I mean, it's, I think sometimes what's happened is that people hold their preferences as truths or true ultimate truths or truisms instead of just true for them or true for them right now. And honestly, what it begins to do is it locks people into a rigid pattern of, you know, of beliefs or patterns of roles or patterns of modes of expression. And then when they are their higher self, you know, when the soul, I look at the soul sometimes as a dial, and when it clicks, when it's, you know, time for some new experiences, some new expressions, if you are so held into a rigid belief system about, you know, who you are, what you are, or how you're defined, it is very difficult to grow. And that, I think, as a spiritual life coach, is one of the most challenging things for me, but what I've learned for me, my lesson is in it, as Michael said, objectivity, neutrality, to not insert myself into their karma or dharma, you know, to offer insight, but not to insert myself into that by stating, now it's time for you to do this or that. Yeah, I just had a situation actually with that, with somebody where I had to really just clear the space. They were coming back to work with me and just really clear the space to see them in a new light, I guess, is the deal. You know, and that's Mystic Light. You have to get rolling. Good to hear you, Michelle. Tea soon. Yes, I'm having my tea right now, actually. I'm going to. But that's one of the things, I think sometimes extreme situations come in your life to desensitize them yourself, to release that situation. Evolution news. Amber, can one's preference be part of their higher order? Oh, absolutely. Oof, that's a good one. Yeah, yeah. And yes, the ego can be used constructively. I love the focus of Buddhist psychology or, you know, Hinduism. We call it Hindu psychology, but, you know, working with the mental realm, as well as esoteric wisdom goes into this also. That in theosophy, the ego personality, what you also call the personality self, is an extension of the soul. It's the physical manifestation or outpicturing of the soul. Now let's look at this, because I love to use this example because this is, it gives it such clarity and also shows how we get led astray when we don't kind of do, you know, etymology, look at the word derivation of things and really study things. We love it when a little baby has a personality. Oh, look at their personality. They have such a great personality, or an animal being. And specifically, I'm thinking of a dog, you know, dogs or cats. What are we saying? They have it's their ego. Oh, we love their personality. But for some reason, when it comes to people, we want them to be personality-less. We don't want them to have an ego. And the truth is the ego that everybody, you know, there's just a lot of misinformation out there. The ego that people are trying to, quote-unquote, get rid of, which you can never get rid of your ego or your personality, the personality self, until you're not in physical form, you're going to have some. Especially as soon as you extend out or self-express, you're expressing through your ego personality as a vehicle, a vessel. But the ego personality, or the ego that people really want to get rid of, and, you know, they spend all this time trying, is the constructed ego, the false ego, the ego that is of people's own making to get approval. You know, we have what's also in the constructed ego, the disowned self, the part of us that, you know, people didn't like or parents didn't like, or not always by what they said, but how they looked. And we got approval. The parts of us that didn't get approval, we kind of stuff away. And, you know, that part, you know, usually that's people that have a heavy constructed ego, usually they're very rigid. People that tend to have less ego, but I want to say more self-expression, are, like Michael said in the chat earlier, flexible and releasable. They're not attached, you know. You know, they're able to say, oh, I don't mind doing this. You know, I don't mind. And Fiona's been, I have a lot from my lessons from my ego, crazy lessons. Well, the thing is, you probably learned a lot about your emotional body not being clear. You probably did a lot out of emotion or reaction. But that's not really, that's not the true ego. That's constructed ego. That's the part of us a lot of times that, you know, we construct things. If I do this or that, then I'll get love. That's not the true ego. That's constructed ego. And then we realize we have this path of relationships that have been awful, or why did they do this to me? That's not true ego. That's something that somebody can, we construct. We've all been there. We construct that, ooh, this got me attention. This got me love. I'm going to do this. And then we wake up one day and we go, wow, I'm such a giver. And I always get selfish people that are taking. And the only reason why that's happened to someone is because at some point, by them overgiving, they got attention or they got love, approval. They got someone to be with them. So they kept doing the same thing over and over, which is not being, if I may, Michael, borrow your statement again and from the chat room, not being flexible and releasable. So when you are in full expression, in other words, your true ego, your personality, you can see if something's unhealthy. Amber is saying this is part of the misinformation that permeating beginning phases of the new age move. Yes. Yeah. But now the ego is trainable. The true ego personality is very trainable, and it is very receptive to spiritual energy, the spiritual impulses, you know, of the higher self, of the soul self. So, and you see that again. I'm going to go back to children, you know, or infants. You, before the socialization or inculcation process takes over, well, they're inculcated with these. This is how you get approval. This is how you get attention. Before that happens, you see them expressing very openly. You don't see them held to rigid patterns. And in essence, that's where we're all getting back to, that openness, that fluidity. In essence, you could say by us being more and more in this way and living this way, we are creating belief systems and thought systems and systems within our culture, within our society, that understand this and allow for this. You know, and that's a huge space of healing to be able to do this, to live your life authentically, you know, to be in that present moment and to know what is you, what is your constructed ego, what is you, you know, what is really you, what is really that spiritual energy or spiritual essence coming through. You know, for many that's being in the, you know, detached observer. Having detached compassion, being in that witness state, the observer. And after you've observed a lot, then you move into the living. You're in that present moment, because even in that observer mode, you're still observing. There still is a separation there. There's the observed and the observing. But once you've got that awareness, some say lesson, but awareness, you automatically move into that space of being. Being in that space of beingness is another way that can term that. Those of you, great, that have questions, have you been doing in the chat by typing in caps? I love it. I love it because I can see the questions and comments easily. Those of you that are listening, I can see on the switchboard, welcome to the program. And if you do have any questions or feedback, just press the number 1 on your keypad, and I will get an alert on the switchboard. great for all of you to be here and sharing in this unfolding. Now, we have our guest today, which really fits in with the topic that we've been all sharing, is a amazing. I've just been reading one of his books, as a matter of fact. We have with us Ronald Alexander, and he is author of Awakening the Buddha Within. His most recent book is Wise Mind, Open Mind. And in the words of Ram Dass, he says, this book provides a wise map to the treasures within. Basically, Ronald Alexander in his latest book is focusing on finding purpose and meaning in times of crisis, loss, and change. He is the director of the Open Mind Training Institute, and he practices mindfulness-based mind-body psychotherapy and leadership coaching in Santa Monica, California. So would love to welcome to the program Ronald Alexander.
Well, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be on the show. Just a simple, real quick correction. I am the author of Wise Mind, Open Mind. Awakening the Buddha Within is authored by my good friend Suryadas, Lama Suryadas, who wrote the foreword of my book.
Thank you. Okay.
Him and I
Okay, great. Thank you for that correction. So your book is, and I'm holding the hand, Wise Mind, Open Mind, Finding Purpose and Meaning in Times of Crisis, Loss, and Change. What if, you know, I'm just going to let everybody know, I love this book, and I don't tout a lot of books. I have a lot of authors on, but this one, very easy to read, easy to understand, and I would say for, you know, wherever you're at on your path, beginning, middle, end. And so apropos for the times that we're in right now, Ronald.
Oh, yeah, because we're in such, as we say in Hindu mythology, we're really in a time of Shiva, the time of a fiery change.
Fiery change. Are we out of the Kali Durga?
Yeah, I think we have come up and caught the new wave. From the Kali Durga and the darkness. And now I think, you know, we're heading towards the light and with crystalline possibilities where after there's a great valley, usually there's a wonderful mountain to start to climb. And one of the things that we discover in Tibetan meditation that's called Big Sky Mind is when you get to the top of the mountain and you can rest in what we call wise mind that I write about in the book, is you can just see the infinite possibilities that are available to us after a very dark time. And I think this nation and this world, we've had a very rough go these last 5 years. But I think we're on to a whole new golden pathway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that you're saying this because, and Michael's saying Om Namah Shivaya to you. Ah, same to you, Michael.
Om Namah Shivaya back.
Okay, you can hear you there. We've got the chat. Our chat room is called the Sacred Space of Empowerment, and it's a wonderful, wonderful group of beings there that share their insight and love to ask questions as well.
One of the first Swamis that I met from the East many, many, many years ago was Swami Muktananda, and that was... the mantra of his yoga, Om Namah Shivaya.
He was a teacher of mine, yeah.
Oh, yeah, a wonderful being. And, of course, his teacher, Bodhi Baba, are you familiar with him?
Yes,
Nityananda?
Yes. Nityananda, yes.
Extraordinary, just extraordinary.
I want to study with him.
At least
not on this dimension, anyway.
Right, but I had an interesting experience. I was once up in South Fallsburg. I was invited to go up there to meet with Guru Mai, the sacred teacher who took over for Muktananda. And she suggested that I go, I guess it was like a cave-like meditation room on the property.
Where Baba meditated,
exactly. And I went in there and I meditated. She said, you know, stay in there for like 2 or 3 hours. And in the floor above, they were doing darshan, so I could hear the violins and the sitars, and they were chanting Om Namah Shivaya. And the interesting thing is I came out, and then this wonderful guide comes up to me, and he's dressed in a suit, and he says, now would you like to meet Badi Baba? And so I thought he said, Buddy Baba, like, you know, my buddy Baba.
Baba, right, my buddy Baba.
My buddy Baba. And so, of course, I said, sure, I'd like to meet your buddy Baba. And I was taken to this other room, and it was complete silence. And there was a film that was probably shot in the 20s, 30s, 40s, black and white, where it showed Nityananda coming out of Samadhi, and he's walking around in a little white pair of shorts, yoga shorts, on top of a roof. And you can clearly see from the vision and the intensity of auric extension in his eyes that his physical body is on this plane, but his consciousness is on the other side.
Wow.
And I absorbed it and have never forgotten the intensity of the Shakti from that moment that I got via a film, of all places.
Yeah. Just, well, they say if you're open, you receive it, you know.
Yeah.
It's a book, a film, a picture. I get goosebumps as you're speaking, Ronald. It's
amazing.
And
did I get it? I mean, it was...
Yeah.
And I remember coming out, and he said, so how did you like... And I thought, again, he was saying Buddy Baba, and I said... Buddy Baba is definitely my buddy and will be forever. And then a couple of years later, I was at Hampton Chutney's down in the village because I was teaching, not in the village, in Soho. I was teaching at the New York Open Center, of course, on the open mind. And I was starting to tell some of the people who were the help there. And this gal pulls me aside and she gives me a Shiva coffee, coffee and chai. And she says, I think you're referring to Badi Baba, Badi Baba, the great saint Nityananda. And then she shows me a picture and gave me a book. And it was just an extraordinary experience.
Yeah, the Shakti is amazing. The Shakti pot to receive that is out of this world.
it's a divine. I think it's a divine gift. It's a divine blessing, when you experience it, it certainly does take you into what my book is about: wise mind and open mind. It takes you into that opening, and I think Shakti pot is an opening. And unfortunately, a lot of people didn't have the opportunity to meet Muktananda when he was alive here in the United States, but many of us did, which I think is a true blessing.
Yeah, well, he came not with a lot of fanfare. And at the time that he was here, of course, it wasn't as cachet, or popular. So
yeah, this whole... he was part of... Right, I think he was part of the first wave, and...
Yes.
This yoga wave is just so huge that I think, like you said, there wasn't a lot of fanfare. And if you got to meet him, I think your karma was blessed. And, if he were to come now, I think he would be able to touch, millions upon millions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I wanted to, and one of the things I love to, jumping back a little bit to your book here, Ronald, Wise Mind, Open Mind, is the focus that you have on creativity and self-expression and using meditation the mindfulness meditation to tap into that and allow that. And you also speak about mindfulness breaking through stagnation. I was really touched by that because to me I think that meditative state is when we are, that God state, and we are in touch with our creative self or self-expression or that which is the creator, the creative. But I haven't really ever heard someone term it that way or use this process for this or this meditation. How did you come about taking mindfulness and applying it in this way?
Well, I came about it in a very unusual way. When I grew up in Boston, and I grew up in the 60s, so when I was in high school, it was 66, 67, 68, and I was a member of a band of musicians, and so I spent a lot of time in Harvard Square, hanging out in the music shops and the bookstores and reading existential philosophy at first, and then I came upon a couple of, you know, very seminal books on the writings of T.D. Suzuki, the early writings on Zen Buddhism and Zen Buddhism and psychoanalysis, and then, of course, Ram Dass's extraordinary book, Be Here Now, and then the autobiography of a yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda. And at the time, I was just an Irish Catholic boy from Boston. I was in business school, you know, first in my class studying and thinking I was going to go into a trajectory of business. And I just had this enormous appetite and thirst for the creative process. And so I would go and hear all the great musicians because they would come over. And usually in those days, they'd stop at either the Harvard Bowl or the psychedelic supermarket or the Lowe's Orpheum or Beacon Theater in Boston, and they would dress rehearsal, and then they would play. So you'd hear the Stones or Cream or Eric Clapton, the Who.
Cool.
And it was just amazing. And something kind of started like a pilot light, started igniting inside my soul about creativity. And then I started getting into Asian music, sitar music, and then classical music. I'd go to the Boston Pops all the time. And I became utterly fascinated with how people like Mozart or Eric Clapton or George Harrison or Peter Townsend or Mark Rothko or Andy Warhol, how did creative people tap into their creativity? Was it something that just naturally flowed out of them? Or did they actually do something with themselves in order to open the gates to flow more freely? And I readily discovered that meditation was one of the most direct paths. And so I had a very unique opportunity when I went to UMass, the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, to study Buddhism at Smith College and minor in it. And I had the opportunity to take a course at a Trappist monastery right outside of Amherst for a week with someone that was teaching Buddhist mindfulness meditation and Christian contemplative meditation. And so I had a direct experience, a direct opening into open mind, and there was a knowing about, okay, this is the place. Open mind is a state of consciousness where all creation and people who are creative, and we're all capable of that, and obviously some of us are far more gifted than others, but I think everybody has their own level of gift, and they also have perseverance, too. For example, you don't have to necessarily be a gifted guitarist, but if you apply yourself, you can certainly become a journeyman. And so I very quickly discovered that the more I meditated, the more I gained access and expertise into this state of what I write about in the book, open mind. And something that when, and I've spent the last 35 years of my life not only studying, but also working with, you know, here in Los Angeles, working with people in the entertainment industry, that people that are very creative spend a certain amount of time every day getting quiet, turning inside, and becoming still.
Yeah, you have to. You have to, you know, I also say you have to fill up. You have to fill back. You have to empty to fill back up to then make that next creative expression, you know, or product or whatever it is.
And that is a very wonderful concept, and I'm glad you brought that up, because once I was at a museum, and there's a vignette about it in the book, and I was standing next to I was with two psychologist friends, and we took the afternoon off to take in the David Hockney show at the L.A. Coney Museum of Art. And we're standing next to an actor who had just finished the Shogun series. And he was standing, and he was absorbing, in addition to observing, this particular series of photographs that Hockney had done. And the three of us kind of went to the side to kind of give him space. And and my friends moved on to the next room, but I stood there, and I waited, and I watched. And for about 10 or 15 minutes, this actor extended his hands and arms out, like as if he was on the cross or feeling into his auric field. And I noticed that he was breathing deeply, and what touched me was he was feeding himself in between television series or movies. That here, this actor, artist, this was how he was nourishing his soul. And he was just actually drinking it in, breathing it in. And I think that we all need to do that, particularly in between creative gigs and in between crisis, pain, and loss. You have to feed the soul.
Yeah, and now why do not, because I've had sometimes people in the industry think that they don't have to do this. Sometimes that seems to be a misnomer that they, like who you're speaking of, obviously knew to do that instinctively. Some people tend to, others perhaps need to be taught this. And our society seems to promote this, that the stream is always there. There, you know, there's this replenishing isn't needed.
Well, I think our society is a society that is very control-oriented and has a certain quality of almost discipline rigidity, unfortunately, to it, where, like, you're supposed to work 40, if not more, hours a week, and Monday through Friday, and you only get a little bit of time on Saturday and Sunday, and very few people get time off during the work day to take care of themselves or to meditate. But in the last 10 years, I've seen some extraordinary breakthroughs in corporations that I've consulted to. For example, I was talking with in a seminar I was leading up at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur on mindfulness and the art of leadership about 5 years ago, and there were a group of executives from Sun Microsystems and also Apple Computer, and they were telling me that the president of Sun Microsystems, and I think his name is Scott McNeely, if I'm correct, that he was in Nepal and that he was taking a 6 or 9 month sabbatical, and that everybody, and I don't have the accurate year here, but it's like every 5 years or every 7 years or every 3 years, that everyone in the company is encouraged to take a month or 3 months or 6 months off. And that in many of the corporations that I consult to here in L.A., I've encouraged them to get what I call a relaxation room, which is really, it's a meditation room. It's a sadhana room.
Mm-hmm.
It's a room where employees can go in, and whether they want to go in and sit and meditate or they want to go in and take a nap, that I say that that will increase productivity and performance rather than to decrease it. That what people we need to do on a regular basis, which is something that I've been doing for 35 years, is I get up and I meditate at 5 o'clock in the morning and set my instrument, because as a musician, I was always taught, you've got to tune your instrument before you pick it up. And then in the middle of the day, I do the exact same thing. I don't take an appointment every day at 3, and I use that time to go into deep meditation. And again, nurturing the soul, nurturing the self, allowing the unconscious to open up, allowing ourselves to access both our wise mind and our open mind, and be able to go into it, that state of stillness and peacefulness that truly is the doorway or the key that accesses core creativity. So I think we have to go through the different cycles of putting energy out and being very productive and intentional and assertive and aggressive in a work effort. And then we have to go into the balancing part of the cycle, which is to drop down into the yin part, which is the relaxed. You know, in Chinese medicine, yin and yang, yang's masculine, yin is feminine. And the yin is the source of creativity, where things, you take things in, you you receive. Yin energy is very nourishing, it's very warming, it's very enlivening.
Yeah, I sometimes think that with the too much focus on the yang or the electrical or putting out, you literally can push things away, you know. But as you're saying, this time to go within and be receptive, you fill up again. And then I like what you're saying. It's a natural cycle that once you're receptive and filling up again, then you naturally are expressing that which you've filled up with.
Right. And not to, to sound name-dropping, but it, it is a true story. I was at a conversation one evening with a group of musicians, and it was shortly after Bruce Springsteen had done five nights at the L.A. Coliseum in the fall of 1985, where he was really at the peak of his career, the Born in the USA tour. And so five nights, you know, 100,000 people every night. And shortly after that, a year later, he was part of the Amnesty, him and the E Street Band, the Amnesty International Tour. And Sting and his band also participated. And so over dinner, there was a conversation between musicians. And one of the things that I was listening to was that Sting had mentioned to Springsteen that he thought like he should pink slip everybody in his band and take some time and just play with other people and play in other genres, whether they be Asian or jazz, that it would be important to sometimes to drop out of the formula of what worked and break things and change things up. And I was always touched by that conversation that I heard, that instead of like keeping the formula because it's working, that true creativity is sometimes breaking it apart. And you know, for example, another great musician that I don't know, but I know of his work, of course, is that Neil Young does this. He's always playing either with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, or he's doing solo folk acoustic by himself, or he's off with his grunge rock and roll band Crazy Horse, or he's playing with a variety of other musicians that include his wife Peggy. And what I think we learn by that, or he's just playing by himself, is what we learn by that is that when we free our mind up and we free our consciousness up, and I think that's what mindfulness meditation allows us to do, it allows us to soften, to slow down, and to let go of a lot of the fixed rigidities that we have about work, about life, about relating, about creating. And it allows us to be a conduit. And in this conduit, I think it's a sacred space. And I think many of the great creators of past times and current times have a respect for that conduit. And I think it's only the anxious people that are afraid to kind of get off the treadmill, metaphorically, creatively. They're afraid to leave it for a while. That get really bogged down and stagnated, and they usually throw back up what I would call formulaic creativity.
Right, exactly. That's the formula.
Yeah.
Now, Ronald, we have a couple questions from the chat room.
Okay.
And one from Debbie that asks, if one has, let's say, a larger ego, is it more difficult for this emptying and opening? And is it impossible, or is it just more difficult?
Great question. The extent in the enormity of the egoic mind is, of course, one of the first hindrances in spiritual practice. Now, if you have a spiritual teacher, if you've had the opportunity like I have to have had some wonderful gurus that really grind down and help you break apart your ego and then soften and melt it so that you learn the process of surrender, it's a lot easier. It's much harder, but it's not impossible. And I think that anyone over time can learn to soften the ego and learn the process of opening up, trusting in the divine, and then surrendering.
Mm-hmm. But and you think and you feel I agree with you though it is easier to do with the teacher.
Yeah, because a teacher is a guide. The teacher is kind of if you think of sailing the great ships in the time of Columbus. Well, they had sexterns and they had compasses, and that's what I think a guru or a teacher or a guide spiritually or a spiritual mentor is, and. If you are familiar with any of the wisdom of the East, it often says that if you open up your heart and you open up your third eye, that the teacher will come when the student's ready. And that's the compass. So it's easier if you have a teacher. If you don't have a teacher, then I think you can do the work, but it's a little bit more difficult.
Yeah. Well, I think we have people on Earth with us. You know, we can't do it all alone, right?
Nope.
Not meant to.
Nope, we're all in this together, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
And nobody's really that much further down the road than any of us. The evolved beings are, but all of us who are in the constant pursuit of awakened intelligence and awakened awareness, we're all in this together. And somebody's a few steps ahead, somebody's a few steps behind, but we're all trying to struggle and support and love in a compassionate way each other towards that enlightened goal.
Mm-hmm. I love how you put that. I think very similar, in fact, that, you know, we're walking this road together. You know, we're all here, you know, on the same the same road. Might be a little bit different approaches, but we're walking side by side.
Yeah, we're all in this together. Whether you're Christian or you're Buddhist or you're Muslim or you're Hindu, we're all headed and going towards that same space of infinite divine possibility.
Ronald, another question here from Liara in the chat room. And when you were speaking about the mindfulness opening us up to our creativity, that our core creativity, she's asking, do you feel that this is part of our awakening, that releasing what's repressed, our repressed abilities, or getting to our repressed abilities? Do you feel that's part of our awakening?
Very, very much so. I see that we come on to this earth, this planet, in essence, from one form of existence to another, regardless of whether one believes in the model of reincarnation or not, that we still are always evolving. And I think this time on earth is really, it's a spiritual school. And as we learn to heal what we call in the Vedas one's samsaric patterns, of pain, affliction, suffering, whether they be emotional, mental, physical, genetic, biochemical, addictions, perversions, patterns of alcoholism, whatever, that as we release our trauma, many, many beings have been traumatized and hurt as children and abused sexually, physically, emotionally, mentally, that as we release and we really do that deep core healing work to release the pain and then the energy around the traumas, that it opens up like a well of being inside at the core of our being, a whole wellspring. And if you think of water as a metaphor of like a gushing, bubbling spring of creativity, so that even the worst traumas can give birth to an entirely new creative way of living as a transformative and creative artist in your own artistry, whether you mm-hmm. ever draw, paint, or even pick up an instrument. One can live very creatively in relationships. One can parent creatively. One can go about doing their job in a very creative way. And I think as you heal that pain and suffering, the creativity becomes abundant. And it's available to all of us right here and now. And all we need to do is begin to start becoming quiet, listening, tuning in, learning to let go, and learning to move on, mm-hmm. which is all part of, you know, my book, Wise Mind, Open Mind.
Mm-hmm. Now, you go in quite in depth in your book on this, but if you can just touch on this here for our listeners, how mindfulness works. What is the basic premise of mindfulness?
Well, the core basic premise of mindfulness is that as you learn to follow your breath and you learn to develop what we call basic and beginning stage concentration, that over time, mindfulness will help you to cultivate what we call the witnessing mind. And I think you were talking about that earlier in the show, correct?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We touched on that, yes.
Yes.
Being the witness.
Being the witness. And so that over time, as the witness becomes more expansive in everyday mind, it delivers you into developing what I call mind strength. And mindfulness leads to mind strength. And mind strength is both the capacity to have mastery over your potential to become non-reactive. And Gandhi, of all great beings, was a wonderful teacher to us because he spent a lot of time mindfully meditating. And by being quiet and listening, he spent a lot of time listening to the messages of the intuitive mind and slowing things down. And so mindfulness really helps us to slow down, tune into our intuition, develop the witnessing mind, deepen our concentration, and then over time develop mind strength, which is really the capacity to develop mastery over being non-reactive, which then empowers us, whether we're mindful leaders or mindful healers or mindful parents or mindful construction workers. It really helps us to function from a place of clear-minded activity with very little emotional reactivity.
Mm-hmm. So in essence, you're getting less and less constricted into the egoic mind when you're doing mindfulness.
Yes, over time, mindfulness will actually, if you think of the house of self, the very first room that you enter in when you open the door to the house of self, when you're getting to know yourself, is really the egoic mind. It's the mind of the ego, and the mind of the ego is, I'm my identity, I'm my role, I'm important, what do I need, what do I want, what do I like, what do I dislike, and it's all the focus is inward on me, myself. And over time, mindfulness helps to soften that, and it takes almost like a spotlight, gently, of our lighthouse, and it guides the ship of self away from the egoic mind, out into deeper waters of the core self, the universal self, where you start to think about other people, and you become other-oriented, and you begin to start meditating on not only your own enlightenment, but on everyone's enlightened awakening, so that we're all going to get there together.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this where we move in from the I to the we?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Because as the egoic mind melts or surrenders or dissolves itself from its hold on your being, naturally, your heart begins to open, or the heart chakra opens up, and then it expands into the we space. And the we space is more other-oriented. It's more seva, or what seva is a Sanskrit word for service. It's you become more concerned generally in the whole planet And instead of just your being, you become naturally and compassionately interested in everybody's being. You become less concerned with
less
your
own. Less reactive, right?
And with less reactivity.
Mm-hmm.
So you really start to think before you speak. You start
mm-hmm.
to think before you act.
Mm-hmm.
I always like the story. I was telling my teacher in Sri Lanka at the monastery that I think that I had my first level of transcendent opening. And it was because I was in the kitchen one night cooking during this long-term retreat. And the other person next to me that was cooking stepped on my foot really, really. He was a big, big, giant guy from Germany. And it really, really hurt. And I took a big, deep breath and breathed all the way out. And I didn't react. And before I could say a word, he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I was so busy trying to make the food good for everyone that I stepped on your toe, and I'm sorry I caused you pain."
Mm.
And in my breath, I had created the space where I was able to actually wait and not react, which then gave him the space to be able to say, "I'm really sorry, you know, please forgive me for my unconsciousness."
Mm.
Which when
yeah.
we have that space, we can start to forgive ourselves for our unconsciousness towards other people and our own unconsciousness and our own unconscious activity towards our own selves. For example, at another time in India when I was meditating by the Ganges River, I spent some time exploring the word forgiveness.
Mm.
And I started to shuttle between my own spot where I was sitting, and then I would sit in the spot of forgiveness and talk back to myself. And I began to go through a whole series of conversations where I was forgiving myself for all these different, let's just call them crimes and misdemeanors towards the self and the soul and other beings, right? And I started laughing too at one point because I realized, as a trial attorney in this mini little trial, that I was taking time, that forgiveness was taking time to truly, it was forgiving to the self.
Yeah.
That's what we need to do. We need to, when we forgive ourselves, we need to take time to give to ourselves something
mm-hmm.
that then releases us.
Mm.
And then
I like that.
Yeah, and then we
yeah.
can become more forgiving with other beings.
Yeah, you know what's interesting too, because most people are very quick in forgiving to want to, you know, reconnect with the other person and give them something, whether it's their time or, you know, a gift. Let's let bygones be bygones. But I love what you're saying, and Mary in the chat also saying, "Wow, she loves this also." That giving to yourself,
giving
that's
to
powerful.
Our, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what where I think when you move out of the egoic self, it's a different kind of self-giving and self-care, which, of course, anyone who has been abused or used or hurt and injured as a child, we always talk about in Western psychology the importance of at some point being able to, in order to move on, that you have to be able to forgive.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I think is at the core, though, is to know that you need to, in the forgiveness process, you need to give something to yourself, which
mm-hmm.
is really at the core of forgiveness. You can't really forgive someone else until you have really given to yourself the time and the energy, the support, the healing,
mm-hmm.
the nourishment that's needed.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Whoa, write that down in the chat, everybody, those listening by phone and later in the archives. That is huge and so true. You can't really give of yourself until you're in that, until you or give forgive others until you've given to yourself.
You have to give first to the self.
First to the self, yes.
First to the
that's
self.
It. Yeah, we don't give from an empty well. It's not really giving, is it?
No, it isn't. That's beautiful.
Really.
That's beautiful. If you give from an empty well, it isn't really giving.
Mm-mm.
If you take time to fill your well, then the water that you give to yourself and then the waters, the healing waters, the waters of forgiveness that you give to other people have nurturance and nutrients, and they have like minerals, metaphorically, valuable spiritual and psychological and emotional minerals in them.
Mm. Now, we had another question from Little Light, and she's asking in the chat, so in regards to, you know, the mindfulness, she says, are we balancing body, mind, intellect, emotion, and spirit?
Oh, very much so. Mindfulness, one of the brilliant qualities of mindfulness meditation, and that's why I think the Buddha was so insistent on mindfulness being an important aspect of anyone's meditation practice. In addition to whatever it is your spiritual practice is, that to spend time mindfully inquiring to what they call the various sense gates of the mind. They say the mind, but it's really using mindful awareness to look at your thoughts, your feelings, your sensations, taste, sound, touch, and what you hear. And those are called the sense doorways into one's consciousness. So mindfulness really helps us in a holistic and an integrated way integrate body, mind, and heart or soul.
Mm. Now, one of the things, and again, I found your book really user-friendly, which is great. What I feel, and I want to get your take on this, Ronald, that you know, in this new, we want to call it new age, Aquarian age, this new consciousness, as you spoke earlier about, you know, in the time of Shiva, working with the light, which is also creativity. As we all are moving as a collective, let's say even mainstream consciousness, eventually into more self-expression, creativism, being creators, being more, and there's books on this already, more right brain accessing from that part of ourselves. Do you feel that
Hello?
Oops, yes, it looks like we got disconnected somehow, and we lost some people on the switchboard. Two callers are back. Ronald, call back. I want to hear your input on that question. Ms. Katiana in the chat is saying, yes, it does. Let's see, who else is saying? So everybody is saying pretty much that it does. That's the one thing that I do find, and that what I did like in this book, I think he's back, that it does tap into that aspect of ourselves to be able to connect into, as Ronald is calling it, that core creativity. Ronald?
Yep.
I lost sound there.
Yeah, the call just went out, so and I've got to jump off in about 5 minutes.
Great. Okay, yeah, we're finished at 1:30. So how pivotal or crucial do you feel that people being able to connect in and do a mindfulness meditation is? How important do you feel that is in our next evolution?
I think it's really essential. I think that if we all spent minimally 10 to 21 minutes a day, regardless of the form of spiritual practice, whether it's mantra meditation or Christian prayer or Christian contemplative meditation or as the Hindus pray through their chanting. Muslims meditate, I think it's 4 or 5 times a day, about a Mecca. I think if we would all spend 12 to 21 minutes a day mindfully following our breaths, paying attention to the process of getting out of egoic mind, slowing down, and listening, and really surrendering, that we could begin to change the entire planet. And there's various schools of Buddhism. There's the Hinayana, the Mahayana, the Vajrayana paths, and without going into a long discussion of all these three different paths, I'll just take the first two and say, you might look at the Hinayana path as referring to it as kind of a narrow path where one is encouraged to meditate and sit on their Zen cushion, metaphorically, to become awakened and to develop the awakened intelligence and to become enlightened. And the Mahayana, which is the middle path or the great vehicle, says, every day when I meditate not for my awakening, but I meditate so that all beings on the planet will become awakened. And then, and only then, like a true bodhisattva, then if I experience my own evolution and progress being speeded up towards spiritual awakening, then I can focus on myself and on my being. But that I sit in order for all beings to become awakened. I meditate mindfully so that when I go out into the world, I'm mindful of all of my actions, words, and deeds, so that I will touch and open the hearts and bring compassion to people and beings who are suffering. And I'll melt pain and anger and rage and outrage. And I think it's very essential that we have a view that mindfulness is like a diamond cutter, that it really cuts through the egoic mind. And by spending that time, 12, 20 minutes a day, we're changing ourselves. And as we change ourselves, we change the self of the planet. And I don't know if it was Stuart Brand or Werner Erhard or whoever it was, but someone said, think locally, think globally, but act locally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we think about that in terms of a spiritual focus, meditate with your own self, but then realize that your light then shines out to the entire planet and it illuminates every being who comes into your presence, has an opportunity to be touched by the quality of the luminous light body that you yourself are manifesting through your sadhana, your creative spiritual practice each day.
So actually, and you do go into this in the book, that as one is practicing mindfulness, it's, yes, for themselves, but not just for themselves, it's extending out. This energy, this light is extending out.
Yes. And the energy extends out into the world, for the world. So mindfulness is really a way of giving to the entire world. So it's not.
See, I think it's not just
a self-centered or self-oriented practice.
See, and I think this is so important, Ron, for people that want to be able to do something. A lot of times people think, you know, I want to be able to do something to help others. But in a sense, what I'm hearing you say is, you know, if in this way, focus on ourself, you know, in healing the self, as our Debbie had said earlier about this balance, you know, body, mind, spirit, intellect, emotion. We are connecting more into that voluminous part of us. And as you're saying, that this light does extend out into the world, so we are helping in that sense.
Most definitely.
Mm-hmm.
That what we do, as Gandhi said, is every action is a political action, not in the political sense of the word, but in the true sense of that what we do has a political impact to help shift and become a shapeshifter in changing the evolutionary vibration of the entire planet.
Now, one thing I really stood out to me in your book, I'm just going to read just a bit here and want you to just touch on this a little bit. You're saying mindfulness helps you access your core creativity by making you aware of your resistance, so that you can choose to let go of it and focus on the present moment. And then you go on to say that many people are still struggling with resistance and feeling unsure of their goals. This, too, I thought was key, because we are in this huge individual and even, you know, global transition, you know, of crises, choice, loss. And many people feel like they know what they want, or they know where they're going, they're sure of their goals. But yet, things are not lining up. And when I read that in your book, I thought, maybe that is part of the key, is they're either not sure or there's resistance.
Yeah, in the earlier part of the book, I talk about the importance of, in the three-step process for spiritual transformation, is the first step is to identify what your resistances are. And I talk in the book about identifying them as hindrances. And mm-hmm. resistance to change is one of the most formative obstacles for any of us to overcome when we want to evolve, or if we want to move on with our lives or do something better with ourselves. And it's so important to recognize that whatever you resist certainly will persist. And one of my teachers, Haridas Baba, who taught me many, many years ago that whatever you run away from will chase you, and whatever you chase after will run away from you. And resistance is very much like that, that whatever you resist is going to persist, and it's going to keep coming back, calling your attention to, are you going to change? Are you going to take action? Are you going to move forward? Or are you going to stay stuck? Mm-hmm. And if you choose to stay stuck, at least bring conscious awareness and mindfulness to that you're making a choice about it. But most of us stay stuck because we're buried underneath our resistances. And, of course, the first key is to start to meditate on what are our resistances to change. For example, with me, I wanted to write this book for the last 7 years. But I think I spent the first 4 years making notes and being stuck in resistance. And one of the things I finally came to with the help of a friend who's a writer was that what I was resisting was that the writing of the book was going to change my life in a creative way. And instead of saying, well, I'm somebody who is an authority who helps other people become creative, that I was going to be able to step into the space that I, too, am a creator, in the way that when I was a younger man, I played music. And once I identified that, it was just extraordinary eye-opener that what I was afraid of was becoming more. That's what I was actually afraid of. I wasn't afraid of failing. I wasn't afraid of becoming less. I was actually fearful that by penning out the book that I would step into the fullness of my potentiality. And I think everybody is afraid in some way of stepping in and harnessing the horse of their creativity.
Well put. And so true, so true. It is usually that fear of, yeah, of being more, expressing more. We have one question from Mary. She's asking if you could explain how we might lessen our own resistance. And I think you just now touched upon that a bit. But how did you do, was it bringing this into your awareness through mindfulness?
Yes, mindfulness first. And then second is, I think, and I write about this in the book, having a mindfulness journal. And if anyone's ever read the wonderful book by Julia Cameron, The Artist Within, she...
Yes.
Yeah, she came up with something called morning pages. And what I suggest is that people adapt morning pages into what I call the mindfulness journal, and that after they come out of meditation, they just let themselves stream of consciousness without any censor, write down anything and everything that they're currently thinking about or feeling or sensing or currently had just taken place in the meditation itself. And I think, and then go back through and start to circle and look for some of the themes that have to do with hindrances, that have to do with fears and anxieties about moving forward. To go back through and circle some of the words that have to do with feeling blocked or stuck or procrastinating or being fearful. And then the third step is to then go get support, to move from the personal self to either sitting with a counselor, a therapist, a coach, a mentor, a spiritual Dharma teacher, a wise old friend, or an authority in, like, for example, sometimes people are afraid of moving on in a field that they're in, and by sitting and getting wise counsel with someone who is 40 or 50 years older than you, you have the opportunity to involve yourself in almost that psychic judo, and a wise person with some real core substance can really help you to shift and get more comfort so that you shift out of the fear and the anxiety and you shift into the excitement and the exhilaration. And once you start to tap, and this is the field of positive psychology that I've been involved in for the last 25 years, and that's that instead of identifying with pathology and pain and suffering exclusively, a wise mentor or a wise friend, someone on your council of support, and I think there's a chapter in the book on the council of support, will help you to do that psychic judo, to teach you the moves, to move you from resistance into possibility. And of course, once you taste possibility and you drink of the well and the waters of what's possible, then you start to feel enlivened, exhilarated, truly passionate and authentic about going after whatever it is that you want. And you realize the only thing that's holding you back is often your own self.
Ronald, this has been amazing and very insightful. We so appreciate you being on Awakenings. And I just want to touch let people know a couple places that you're going to be, or a few places you're going to be at. Tuesday, October 20th, you'll be at the Bodhi Tree, and that's in West Hollywood, California. Friday, October 23rd, another bookstore talk and signing at Mystic Journey Bookstore, and that's in Venice, California. And Saturday, October 24th, you'll be at the Learning Light Foundation. And for more information, people can go to ronaldalexander.com. And again, we've been speaking with Ronald Alexander, the author of Wise Mind, Open Mind. Yes, Ron?
Yeah, and also this Sunday we're having a dual book launch with Dr. Judith Orloff, my close friend and colleague who wrote Emotional Freedom in Second Sight, and she and I will be at the Exhale Center for Sacred Movement in Venice, California, doing a workshop from 1 to 4 and then a book signing from 4 to 5. And you can get more information on that off the website.
And what is it? Is this one at Exhale?
Yes, Exhale. It's the Center for Sacred Movement, exhalespa.com,
yes,
in Venice, California.
Okay, and what day is that, do you know?
That's this Sunday, the 20th.
The 20th, okay.
It starts at 1 o'clock. And if you want to purchase the book, just go to www.amazon.com, and it's Wise Mind, Open Mind.
Wonderful. Yeah, there's a link to the book straight to Amazon on the Awakening segment page. Thank you so much, Ronald, for being with us.
This was a delight.
Wonderful.
Take
wonderful.
Care.
Very insightful.
Namaste to everyone.
Namaste.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thank you, listeners, for being with us, participants. You are what makes Awakenings part of the converging flow. And all that will be listening later in the archives and via iTunes, and those that are listening via Cosmic Dimensions, thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, continue to shine your light, share your insight, and keep awake. Awakenings Radio airs every Wednesday and Friday, 12 p.m. Pacific Time. For more information, you can contact info@selfinlife.com. Until next time, shine your light.